Welcome to Inside Analog Photography Radio Program. I'm your host, Scott Shepard, and of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is all about traditional process photography. We talk about instant photography. We talk about black and white. We talk about color film. We talk about dry plate, wet plate, you name it, alternate printing processes, everything going on in analog photography. And of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is brought to you by Fujifilm over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. They have beautiful C41 color neg, black and white, color chrome, and of course, instant. Instant film rocks. These guys have so much great things going on right now with instant film. Of course, they have the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4.5 color, black and white, high speed black and white. But you know what's even cooler? They have the Instax cameras and film. The Instax Wide is in the country, available everywhere. And of course, right now, brand new, the Instax Mini is now in the U.S. They have cameras. They have film. This Instax Mini is 2.5 by 3.5. It's the size of a business card. This is really fun stuff. You got to check it out. www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab, the place to send all your film to get developed, proofs, you name it. They got a great workflow going. www.richardphotolab.com, DR5. For the most unbelievable proprietary process to turn your black and white film into positives, into chrome. You won't believe until you get your film back as a piece of chrome will blow your mind. The dynamic range, the latitude, it's just unbelievable stuff. Definitely check it out, www.dr5.com. Iger Studios, Lenny Iger, the place to have high-resolution scans done. You know, a lot of people now are shooting analog. They're using a high-resolution scan. They're making digital negatives on an inkjet, or maybe they're going straight to an inkjet output. But they're making digital negatives and they're printing contact prints. They're doing all the stuff you need to get a high resolution scan. They're using an Aztec Premier, 8,000 PPI, adjustable aperture. They can give you scans that are basically grain free. They can adjust it for every kind of film out there. This is crazy stuff going on with Lenny Iger and the guys at Iger Studios. Check them out, igerstudios.com. And of course, Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com, the camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder. Our media partners, www.apug.org, the Analog Photography User Group, the place on the web for all things analog process. This is a great place to learn, to share information, to get tips and tricks, the community for analog photography, www.apug.org. And of course, our photographic philanthropy partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, www.geh.org, the place to go to find out about the history of traditional analog photography. These people are keeping this alive. They have over 7,000 cameras in their museum of everything that's ever been made, including the Hasselblads that were shot on the moon. You name it. They have the collection. This is a great way to help support. You can be a member of George Eastman House organization. They have a lot of great things going on, but this is something you can do to help give back to photography, to help keep traditional analog photography alive for generations to come. Definitely check them out, www.geh.org. On today's Inside Analog Photo, we're going to have with us Paul Waldman. Paul is the director of LAMP, Living Americans Masters Photographers Project. What a great thing he's up to, capturing the essence of these very iconic photographers, just to let people know what they're up to actually get a picture of the photographer himself and this background that he's doing in this research, and it's just beautiful work. Paul, how you doing today?
It's going great, Scott.
Thanks for joining us here on Inside Analog Photo. Great to have you on the program. We're going to be talking today about the Living American Master Photographer Project. You're the administrator of LAMP. And I wanted to talk today about this whole project you've been doing now for many, many years. What is it all about and what you've been up to here? So thanks for joining us, Paul. And tell us, what is LAMP? What is the Living American Master Photographer Project?
Well, the Living American Master Photographers Project, or LAMP, as it's known throughout the world, is basically an ongoing living document. And I stress the word living because the project isn't designed to be a personal book or a long-term piece of my work. It's designed as an intimate portrait and interview study, as much as it is designed to use that information to create a foundation for larger, broader, deeper, richer understanding of the evolution of national perspective as well as our emotional evolution.
So tell me how you got together to actually create this nonprofit. You guys are a 501c, and this is basically to, like you said, help give people awareness of these American master photographers. So tell me about the origins of LAMP and how you got this going. This has been around now for how long have you guys been doing this?
Just over 18 years.
Wow.
I started LAMP a long time ago. I, at one point, was the managing editor for an arts and culture magazine called Zone Magazine. And at that time, I confronted the editor, who was actually a very, very dear friend of mine, about where the magazine was going. When would we see some legs to the value that we were creating in the magazine? So he basically said, when I asked him for a percentage of the magazine, because I wasn't getting paid hardly anything, I said, well, 3% or 5% of zero equals zero, because he had been promising key employees that they would all get a piece of the magazine when it was sold. And he didn't want to give me that percentage. And I said, well, I'm out of here. And very quickly, the rest of the staff jumped off. The magazine lasted about one more issue. I had to figure out something to do with my life. And as an avid book collector, I had been learning photography basic through an intuitive osmosis process. I had a girlfriend who was an aerial photographer, Carolyn Herring, who still has no idea how she impacted my life. In any event, she saw some of the snapshots I had done and said, you have to start photographing. And at that time, I was living in an art gallery, and my degree is in creative writing poetry, so I really didn't have a background in photography. And I thought you had to be some kind of a math wizard to understand quickly to computate the various f-stops and shutter speeds necessary to create a good image. And it started there. Fortunately, Carolyn, wherever you are, thank you. She has no idea her impact. But since then, I had started to use my father's Vietnam-era Nika mat. And I stress Nika mat, or Niko mat, because it wasn't a Nikkor mat. It was a Japanese version that my father had gotten during his time in the Air Force. So basically, when I left Zone, I saw that there were no editorial images of these photographers. And I thought, photography is changing the world. It is quickly becoming, or had become, what I call a social ambient, in the same way that the cell phone is a social ambient. I mean, you go into a restaurant or a mall or a party, and you hear a cell phone ring, and immediately everybody reaches for their pocket. And photography had created such an ambient presence that I realized that within 10 feet of anybody, there was a photograph. As a matter of fact, a lot of the time when I talk to people on the phone, I'll say, I'd be willing to bet that there is a photograph within 10 feet of you, if you're not looking at one right now. And if not, you're probably sitting on one. And people break out laughing. It's a great little icebreaker. But truth be told, it is like that. And there is an enormous power to the image. The photograph conveys a set of nested ideas or memes. And through this, it is able to convey very deep messages almost instantaneously. And they can unfold in an individual's mind slowly, or they can unfold rapidly as in an epiphany. This is much of what gives the image its power. This is why the still image will never die, because now still images can be combined in a presentation with audio, either music, or can be combined with an interview. You can run that as a soundtrack underneath that presentation if you want additional depth or a different experience for the end user. So I don't believe that the still image is going anywhere. I think that videography is a vital and powerful tool for the imaging professional, but it's not a substitute for the still image. In any event, in 1991, when I left Zone Magazine, I said, I've got to do something with myself. My headspace is heavily invested in my role as managing editor. I needed something to think of myself. I needed a title. I needed an identity, because so much of my identity was tied up in the magazine. And so I started with this idea of the living master photographer. Why weren't they being photographed, and what was being built at the time? And this rolled around in my head for quite some time, a month or so. And I started gathering the philosophical and concrete or physical aspects of what I wanted represented by the project. I believe in June of 1991, I formally started working with the project. photographing Edward Weston's protege, Ruth Bernard, who was then in her mid to late 80s, as the first participant in the project. After that, I photographed Alan Dutton, who was in the Museum of Modern Art, also living in Arizona. And then I started telling people, I'm the director and the founder of the Living American Master Photographers Project. I'd love for you to join the project. Can I send you a mission statement for the project? And some of the photographers were open to this. I would say, well, I'd hate for you not to be represented. I think that the community would be without you if you weren't part of the project. And people got turned on by the idea, and they decided to participate. And then I got a few more and a few more, and the project just grew from there. Then in, I believe, February of 2004, using, I forget the name of the place, in New York, it's a library, but basically it helps match individuals up that want to start a nonprofit with lawyers and other volunteers to do work. And we got some wonderful support there. An attorney named Stuart Levy from Skadden, Arp, Slate, Meager, and Flom decided to help the project out and get behind it. An attorney at the firm, Jin Zai, phenomenal attorney and a wonderful individual, actually did the work of incorporating LAMP as a 501c3 project. So the project actually became a 501c3 nonprofit on February 4th of 2004, which was a wonderful birthday present for my father, who has his birthday on the same day.
Did you find that bringing the organization to a 501c3 status helped in any way?
In my mind, I wasn't familiar with the 501c3 status. In my mind, that meant, well, you'll get money. People will be able to donate and give tax-free donations, and then you're going to be able to achieve more of the goals that the project had. And it was a very difficult decision for me because in many ways it signaled the end of my direct involvement in the project. Because as a 501c3, I would have to leave my position as the photographer for the project because it would represent a direct conflict of interest. I would be using a 501c3 organization to promote my work as a photographer. And that just is in direct violation of the rules of being a 501c3 organization. But I felt it was so important that people be exposed to the idea of this ambient influence being exerted on them. I mean, from images of things we want to buy versus images like Steve McCurry's Afghan Girl, which made the cover of National Geographic and has since become the most famous cover of the magazine. So the photograph had achieved omnipresence in modern society, and no one was looking at it from a whole perspective, from an industry perspective, from an intimate perspective. The people that were creating these, what was the effect of being a professional witness in collecting this information? What was the intimate effect on them? What could they offer as vessels of the witness model? And how can we benefit from this constant collection that they submitted themselves to, this process of selection? And I just kind of went from there. At this point in time, the project suffers from the work that I've done. I always love it when people say that the work I've done in the project is wonderful, that they are just floored by the images, but to the same extent, people associate it as my project, as if I'm the photographer and I need to be honored and I this and I that. And really, this is something that I wanted to continue. It was a legacy effort. One of the things that I used to tell people is to think about the Sears catalog when they first started introducing images. The way a lady's garment was photographed back in the early 20th century is very different than what you might see today. And because of that, we can track the evolution of our commercial values, how we are inspired to purchase things, which translates into economic incentive. Then we can look at things like the civil rights movement. Dan Budnick, who's in the project, did some wonderful work on the civil rights movement. That work, as it gained exposure, led to social changes as people were exposed to this content through magazines like Life and Time and other American magazines, other American media, through war imagery like that of Eddie Adams, who has been an icon. Just the word photojournalism brings Eddie's name to mind. But how many people know what Eddie looked like if they never met him in person? So images become more like landmarks. I'm one of those people, I'll say, how do I get there? Well, if you say, go to this street, there's a church on the corner, and you make a right. Then you go to this street, and there's a big tree with a brick fence next to it, and you make a right there. And follow it down three houses till you see the yellow one with the car parked in front, something like that. So people were identifying photographers not by who they were, but by those images they were associated with, as opposed to who they were. And this is all tied into that vintage notion that a photographer should be like a fly on the wall. We've come a lot farther from that point of origin, and photographers are no longer a fly on the wall. Moreover, their responsibility has changed to be much larger than that of a fly on the wall. Photographers are now targeted for assassination, photojournalists with reference to photojournalism. Commercial photographers are responsible for multi-million dollar campaigns. Their images are what incite people to specific behavior. So in many ways, photographers are also the poets of behaviorism. So there's so much that goes on economically. There's so much that goes on philosophically. There's so much that goes on socially and politically through the application of the image. Governments and warlords and corporations are starting to understand this very quickly because the result can be devastating to them. During our presence in Iraq, we had the Abu Ghraib incident. You saw the most powerful nation in the world pirouette like a ballerina around cell phone images. And they weren't world-class images. They weren't the images of Pulitzer Prize winner. They were just cell phone images. But because of what the photograph had come to represent in the minds and hearts of anyone regularly exposed to the image, our nation responded like a dancer on this topic, as if it was like a ballerina in a music box. The United States pirouetted its political, social, and economic behavior on this one incident, in the same way that our former President Bush used 9/11 in every speech, because he knew of all the imagery and all of the emotional connection tied to that event. We have to start appreciating that there is more to the image than just what we see on paper. There is an accumulation in the people that do it, and there is a value in that that we are not accessing, that we are not mining, that we are not utilizing. And much of what I hope grows out of LAMP centers on this additional content, not the content of the photograph itself, not the content of an interview, but the idea that these people represent a national treasure. That, for example, conflict photographers have to live with being able to sleep, for example. What would be the value to the pharmaceutical industry if they learned the strategies of sleep, or the medical community, if they learned the strategy of sleep for someone that goes from one conflict to another, or one ravaged area to another, and has to be able to function the next day so that they can withstand the same exposure, the same social, political, intimate exposure, being riveted by children in despair, by women in despair, by men in despair, boys in despair. They have to come to grips with that. They have to digest this. It has to go through their system in such a successful way that it allows them to continue. And that isn't being particularly accessed. And that can be translated into economic value. I've been a lot more focused on the economic value of the project because in these tough times for nonprofits and other organizations that support them, money is what it's all about. And kind of getting back to the whole nonprofit thing, I kind of thought that with nonprofit status would come this deluge of support, which never came. I kept on holding my breath, spending more and more money out of pocket, until I was sleeping in people's basements and on people's couches so that I could create an image, just because I had become hypnotized by my own sense of urgency that these people were dying. And if I didn't do this, or if I couldn't get other people to join me, then these people would be gone. And that was just too much for me to take. So I had something in front of me. If I didn't do it, it wouldn't get done.
No, and I think that's the correct statement, that because you did achieve a 501c status. Very interesting that it didn't actually help financially or anybody else giving support to the project, because in theory it is a nonprofit, but you would have thought that maybe some of the other corporations and bigger companies and even other grant people would be more involved in said project because it was a 501c. But it seems that the nonprofit status hasn't really helped financially to keep it alive.
Not at all. As a matter of fact, I learned a lot about the nepotism that goes on in the nonprofit community. A lot of times these organizations, they'll set up in tandem nonprofit portion of the organization and a for-profit portion of their organization. Through educating myself as a board member to be a more effective presence, I learned about university-sponsored programs. I learned about where the money is going. And frankly, if you're not for a health issue, you're not for children, you're not for the homeless, there's very little money available for humanities-based organizations. Yet all of these organizations, whether they're nonprofit organizations or corporate entities, they all have one singular aspect in common, and that is they use the photograph to communicate 90% of their information. What we get when we look at an advertisement or annual report or a website initially is the photographic content. And this has been a shift in the whole industry. Text that surrounds an image has gotten smaller while the image has become larger. That's in itself part of that shift in belief. How the photograph is connected to belief. In modern society, the editorial content has shifted from a text-based format to one of an image-based format. And this can be most readily seen in the dying of newspapers, photographic agencies, magazines, all these things relying more on the image and make their publications smaller. So there's not the greater need. Yet the need for image content remains consistent. One of the things that I've been very interested in, insofar as educating young photographers, is that the demand for imagery is constant. There's no worry about losing demand. That's not why we're facing many of the issues of the day insofar as the economic impact on the photographic community. What has happened, emerging media venues have to be amortized into the past paradigm of how images were used and what their platforms were. When you have the internet and PDFs and things of this nature coming in and infringing on the magazine on a print-based venue. But that idea that the camera is the individual, this is paramount. And what we gain as photographers by continually lifting this vehicle of expression to our face, I tell people every time they lift a camera to their face, they're about to change the way they see the world. And as they see, they evolve emotionally, they become different. Their sense of beauty evolves. Their sense of compassion evolves. Everything that we need to address the technology revolution can be addressed through the camera. We are not emotionally evolved enough for the technology that we currently employ. And through the camera, we are able to evolve more quickly on that level. The more they are refined, the better the images that we see.
So let's talk about how you record these American Living Masters. Is this done with a portrait and then some additional backup of audio video? How do you sort of document what you're doing here with the project?
It's a very interesting question because I had to learn all this on the fly. I remember when I first started recording the interviews digitally, without a background in audio engineering or audio recording from a technical perspective or the technical aspect of creating and importing audio into the computer, I started with an older generation iPod that you could put these attachments on. And one of the attachments allowed you to basically make a digital audio recorder out of an iPod. And I thought, this is terrific. It's portable. It allows me to capture audio. At that point, I didn't realize the kind of quality that could be created, or I didn't know what was out there. So I arrived up in Prescott at Alan Dutton's winter home. He said, well, Paul, we can do the interview at the table, or you can go with me to Seligman, Arizona, where I'm going to be shooting some work. I said, let's have the road. We did, and Alan, who's an extremely articulate man, started quoting Tennyson and musing lyrically as we took his Ford F-150 pickup truck down these side roads and back roads in the backcountry of Arizona. As a matter of fact, Alan had done work on documenting old Route 66. In fact, he was friends with Ansel Adams and Cole Weston. He actually taught Nick Nolte photography and was friends with Minor White and Gary Winogrand. So, a really interesting fellow. But the end result was that the audio sounded like a bunch of garbled ambient noise. But the picture that I was able to take of Alan was so much more soulful, having him on location. and having him in the process of his love, that the image became one of my personal favorites. But it also represented the enormous challenge of creating audio content for an interview back in 1991. That was some kind of feat. It was very difficult, as opposed to you're a reporter and you're taking down notes, and then you write a story around, and then you include a couple of quotes from an interview, that type of thing. So we went from that, and later I got DigiDesign MBox with the Pro Tools recording software, started recording directly to hard disk using an iBook at that time. As a matter of fact, when I recorded Marty Lederhandler, he was telling the story of how he photographed Fidel Castro and Nikita Khrushchev at the UN. He said how he got down right in front because he knew that as soon as these two met, they were going to embrace. And this was at that time of the embargo and all of this stuff was going on. Just as they came together, the UN President banged the gavel. And right at that moment in the interview, his neighbor upstairs decided to do some home repair and started banging a hammer. At first it was like, he's just telling the story and there's this hammer coming in. And I was so upset. I was thinking, how can I get this out? And it wasn't only until I gained some perspective and had some time to look back on it that I could appreciate the serendipity surrounding that kind of guerrilla audio journalism, so to speak. So, but an evolution in technology and portability at one time after the project was incorporated, I wanted to get Lucian Perkins, who's a two-time Pulitzer winner with the Washington Post. I wanted to send to Lucian a portable audio interface that he could take with him. So you could imagine these guys that were embedded in the war, if you had some kind of 3D IMAX sound of what was happening around them, that could be a very powerful tool. Not to mention hearing that woman that talked about from Steve McCurry, that Afghan girl, hearing what she sounded like 17 years ago, and then hearing what she sounds like at this time, and how, just like her image, her voice had changed over time. So that's very interesting. And the project is at a stage right now where participants can be rephotographed. As a matter of fact, almost a year ago to this date, I rephotographed Bob McNeely, who was President Clinton's personal photographer, and actually did a little audio thing with his son, because we did an audio interview at that point. That was quite interesting. He talked about his years at the White House.
So you shot these portraits, you have some audio content that goes with this. Is this stuff up on the web?
Dafoda has donated an interactive flash-based website to the project, and I have some of the audio up there, like Marty Lederhandler's pigeon story, Volkmar Kurt Wenzel's photographic initiation, and some other audio. But it's really up there in a very loose way. But right now, thelamp.org, www.thelamp.org, is, quote, under construction, but it's still out there. It's like instead of having some magical release party where everything is right, I just put it out there. And the irony is that it took the passing of a number of our great masters to make this an issue. And people often ask me, am I upset that there have been one or two books on portraits of photographers that have come out? Am I upset that they're now doing these things like this social documentary practices piece that was up today on the web? This webcast, that these things are coming out and my name isn't associated or I'm not making any income from that. I'm really happy that I was there to make this an issue. And if people don't remember LAMP and my involvement specifically, inspiring them one way or the other through word of mouth or through direct connection to participants or other venues, at least the change is happening. But I have the 6-year-old son now at 47 as a single father. And I have a responsibility to him to show him the value that we have to create in life, that part of that process of enabling ourselves can be repurposed through financial gifts or volunteering. I can instill that in him. And I'm really hoping that there's a book. As a matter of fact, if you want help, really would love to create a 20th anniversary book for LAMP. I mean, I always thought LAMP would make a great textbook, like a coffee table hybrid textbook. But so many people, they focus on the image, that the image is the artwork, and the image is not the artwork. The individual is the artwork, and the print is what's left behind because the individual invested time in the creation of themselves. That's a rather backward way of looking at it, and people just don't seem to get that.
Is there opportunities for people to get involved with the project if they want to help donate time, recording some of this content? How does that work? How do you work out with accepting help?
Well, I've had some wonderful response recently from two very talented photographers, one in Las Vegas and the other in New York, that would like to get involved in the project. There's a big difference between wanting to get involved in the project and actually doing work. So I'm hoping that that will pan out. I really need help in so far as photographing and interviewing people. That's obviously an omnipresent need. But I also need people to help with nuts and bolts portions of the project, getting this thing back. A lot of these documentary places, they want to document an individual issue. It's like Africa, the Congo, or Asia, this issue or that issue. But they never want to look at the evolution of how we see is changing. And they never want to embrace the community and what the community can offer from that perspective. I had hopes for the Annenberg Foundation, the Annenberg Space for Photography. I had hopes for the Smithsonian. I had hopes for Duke's Documentary Center and many other places, but I keep getting the same response. And that is, we don't want to take on a project as large as LAMP, or we don't have the budget to do that. So I kind of find myself up against a wall. There's just so much about the project. It's epic in scale, and I think that's what scares people. But it's also the type of thing that inspires them and should continue to inspire them. But I always looked at the LAMP book as being something that as older masters passed, newer masters emerged. And that was one of the big things that kept me involved with the project. A lot of these participants like Marty Lederhandler and Volkmar Kurt Wenzel and Arnold Newman. Volkmar and Arnold have passed. I don't believe Marty has passed. You just live in fear that one day you're going to call and the number is going to be disconnected, or you're going to get their spouse or their child or their grandchildren answering the phone saying, "Oh, we're very sorry, but so-and-so has passed away." The only thing that keeps my heart from sinking is the emergence of new masters and the vitality of the community. So keeping these people alive and their work relevant has become a division of LAMP in itself. Also, I've been working hard to create international satellites through what I call the LMPP, Living Master Photographers Project, recently in Russia, trying to create a Living Master Photographers Project Russia, because they have such outstanding photographic talent there. I'd like to start one in just about every major country around the world so that we can get the evolution of global perspective. I think that would really help significantly move us towards a sustainable, actual, viable world peace. And the camera has this enormous value. I mean, Czech media philosopher Willem Flusser said, "The photograph is the most important invention since the written word." And I tend to agree with him.
Do you find that you would classify people doing digital photography and digital imaging and Photoshop and manipulation as a photographer? Or would you consider them a photographic or maybe a image creator?
Well, that's part of the evolution of the art and craft of photography. As I mentioned previously, I look at the eyes as being the camera. And when considering photographic manipulation, as we're starting to see more and more in Photoshop, is what's happening in the mind's eye. Do we interpret imaging in the mind's eye as a photographic process, or do we attribute that venue to the world of illustration? I think that in many respects, that's up in the air. I think that what we're starting to see more is how people are playing with the ability to touch time, this fractional rubbing of the timeline. But I think that being a purist at heart, my own personal perspective, I like to see shots very pure. That's what I loved about working in medium format with Hasselblad and other medium format cameras as well, and with the square, and you can't wait. You can't do any kind of waiting with a square that you can with 35 millimeter with a rectangle. And my personal feeling is that photography is about truth. And when you start manipulating that truth, you start taking a certain level of that truth from it. But I'm as guilty as a lot of people for photoshopping a blemish or a hair that's kind of flown out and just kind of, "Oh, this image would be perfect if." And I'm like, "Oh, I went through all this trouble just to take this one shot. And it's just this one hair that's out of place." It really doesn't impact the time or the collective content of the image to remove a hair or a blemish or something like that. But when you get into changing the subject, like making the subject thinner or giving them a longer neck or thinning the face or stuff like that, But then there's also the direction where people are creating false history. If that's done, people have long since questioned the validity of some of Robert Capa's work as being staged, or Doisneau's work as being staged. And I think that there's nothing wrong with some of that as long as it's stated. It's all about creating an idea, whether it's the perfect kiss or a tragic moment in conflict. It's about creating the message that's going around that's in the air. Photography really is our ability to interact with time, and that's a pretty heady thing. So I think that to a certain extent, we have to cut ourselves a little slack. So then those people that are doing all kinds of just wild work, or artists that think that the fringe or the outer edges of the craft or the art define it. And I disagree with that. There's an inner life that's like defining the sun by the light it creates while ignoring the corona and the inner workings of the sun. To say that that is less important than the light that we experience on Earth is rather ridiculous. But I would love it when I get that image with the square. Personally, I hate cropping images. It's something that artistic way, but I rarely will crop an image. I don't like that at all.
No, it's just a thought that I had that we have these American masters of photography, and then, like you said, you're stating that the image is created in their eye and whatever camera they use or process goes through. But then you look at the point of all this manipulation and electronic imaging, and I don't know if it distorts anything or it's just an interesting concept.
I think that the closer you can create to that point of origin, expressing exactly what you want on the film, I think that that is quintessentially where you want to be when you meet time. When Cartier-Bresson would find his place and wait for the image to enter the space that he had chosen, at that moment that he clicked the shutter, that made it perfect. And that's one school of thought. But there's so much happening in photography. I'm really more invested in how we're changed as individuals by being filled with this ability, this technical and artistic craft that's just like less than 200 years old. I mean, it's amazing. It's changed everything. So there are people like Chuck Close, for example. Would I consider Chuck a master photographer? Yeah, in many ways I would, and I'd love to have him involved in the project. But then we have people like Lucian Perkins and Dave Burnett, who I would just love to be able to document and bring into the project. I think there's a lot of seduction that goes on with the digital image. The idea that we've had the photo god taken away, we don't have a little Buddha that we can pray to that says, oh, I hope I got this. I sent it off to the lab, I pushed it, I pulled it, I couldn't see it when I took it. I know what I did when I did. I know the moment that I pushed that shutter. There's a spiritual union, a physical union that took place at that fraction of a second. That convergence occurred, and digital kind of takes us away from that. Motor drives took us, in some respects, away from that, gave us more choice around an image. Did the motor drive really change that, or was that like cheating? So I think that you got to look at the whole person, at how the work has evolved, what they've contributed to the craft. Have they taught? Have they taken time out to contribute? And things of this nature. Many people gave me flack for including wedding photographers among masters. But I think that they should definitely be included in the project. There's so many different genres. A woman that I was talking with recently, Denise Trischello, who founded Wire Image in Las Vegas, she was saying that Getty had told her that of all the photographers in the world, she had photographed more birthdays than anyone to date. And she was musing about that honor, quote unquote. Yet she did probably the single most amazing portrait of Edouard Bouvard. He decided to mentor her. You can see it in the work instantly. She agreed not to display the image until after his death because he was very, very sensitive about his image. I mean, when you think about it, your photographic image is like giving away your social security number or your fingerprint. It identifies you so specifically, and with new facial recognition technology, even more so. So for people like me that are deathly afraid of having their image taken or just very sensitive, I mean, to me, letting somebody take my picture is very much an intimate gift because there's only one person in the world that can give your image, and that's you. When I approach a subject, I think of it like that. That they're giving me a gift. It's up to me to approach them and to accept that gift with the kind of humility and appreciation and any talent that I can contribute. These things are central to me as a portraitist. as much as anything else that I put into my documentary work. But we're not so into photography like we're into painting. I mean, painting started on the caves of Africa in Europe. There were illustrative expressions. We've had photography for 200 years, and we can't have the collected hubris of that much time to allow the belief that we have somehow mastered its handle. What we get out of photography and what we contribute back to it is still very much a young process. As Native Americans would say, it's still soft. Like when it rains, the earth becomes soft. It must be new. And photography is still soft. It's still very new. I hope everyone that listens to this broadcast takes to heart when they lift that camera to their eye that this inspiration enables their vision, enables their humanity to come back and influence them on an intimate level, on a deeply personal level. So I hope that that's one of the things that comes out of this. I mean, it's one of the reasons that I agreed to do this because I haven't done a lot of interviews, but I sensed your truly genuine interest, this excitement, enthusiasm, and applying everything, as Felix the Cat would say, in your bag of tricks to pull these new ideas out. Because not everything, not all advances are technological. They have to be in concert with our ability to use them. And when our ability matches our creation, magical things happen. We are increased exponentially, and this is my primary hope for the camera, that it becomes an exponential vehicle for us to match the technical outgrowth that we've been fortunate enough to experience, and I'll be clear on that.
So tell me here, Paul, about how people would get in contact with you, how they would find out about the project, how people can get involved if they want to help. I mean, how do people get involved with the project to try to help continue this documentation of the great American masters?
Well, I think that the first thing that they can do is talk about it. That's easy and it's free, just the word of mouth. They can include me in the discussions as opposed to just taking ideas that they hear from me and then use their own talents to create their own things. I mean, I think that there's been a lot of theft from LAMP in my ideas. Not that I harbor any ill will. It serves the mission, and I care more about the mission than I do about the credit. But there's some beautiful things happening out there, like Tim Mantuani's Polaroid project, where he's photographed actually more photographers than I have using the Polaroid 20x24 camera. In fact, I was one of his subjects. I met Tim when he was still the first assistant to Dean Collins, one of the early participants in the project, who unfortunately and sadly died relatively young. I think he was 55 of cancer, and Tim had his own bout with that, which added as a catalyst to his interest in photographing photographers. But LAMP's been out there treating the photographer as an editorial subject just about as long as anybody. I mean, the only person that I know that was doing such remarkable work was Bill Jay. And Bill was a wonderful portraitist, but still there wasn't this radical idea that you can create a living project, an ongoing study, that the camera has become such an important part of our life, that the photographic image has become such an omnipresent, riveting catalyst for contemporary society that it must be documented. And so when I tell people that what they can do is speak out, that's the first thing. Sally Mann, among others, had lobbied Michael Hoffman at Aperture before he died to do a book on LAMP. But they refused it because I think, in essence, the photographer is symbolic, that it's not the photographer that's important, it's the work they create. And like I said previously, the photographer is the art. The images are what happens when life creates art out of an individual, or an individual is transformed into an object of art. But more specifically to contacting me personally, people know me around the world as Mr. LAMP, MRLAMPP. I'm Mr. LAMP at yahoo.com. I'm Mr. LAMP on Skype. I'm also Paul at thelamp.org for as long as that lasts. But without funding, there's another thing people can do. They can give me money. As a matter of fact, on Facebook, for my last birthday, I asked for donations. And there were some really kind people, and we were able to raise, I think, $250 or $275. But that's not even enough to buy an audio interface, let alone a microphone. So I actually contacted, or tried to contact, Facebook to give these people back their money, because that doesn't even pay for my work. So I just tried to get them back their money, and I'm still in the process of trying to give them back their money. More what I want is an institution to either partner with LAMP or to buy the project or absorb the project or something like that, because the mission needs to be continued. Man is evolving exponentially, and the camera can be a vehicle of such enormous change. It can be the great negotiator because it can contribute these ideas that are central to the human experience. But those are ways they can look at the work. They can think not how great my work is. I think right now at this point in time, the project suffers more from the fact that people love the portrait so much. They compliment me, and I'm really glad that the photographs inspire you. Give me a job so that I can take some of my income and put it back into the project. But in any event, it's truly epic. And when Flusser said that the image is the most important invention since the written word, that's a pretty big statement. It's like bigger than Gutenberg's Bible. I mean, that's enormous. And what's even more overwhelming is that it's true. I mean, count how many images are within 10 feet of you, and then go into another room and count how many images, and then go outside and see if you see any images. It's just all around, and we carry our licenses, a picture of ourselves. And so there are all these different things that contribute to this omnipresence of the photograph. So it's something to consider, along with the fact that the people who create these images are carriers of that experience, carriers of that wealth of becoming the vessel of history. How do you quantify and how do you value a vessel of witness, a vessel of history? So give me money, give me a job, which I'd like more. Give me a place to fish and teach me how. That would be great. If not, call me. I'm very approachable. MrLamp@yahoo.com, paul@thelamp.org, Mr. Lamp on Skype. As long as you tell me who you are and why you're contacting me, I'm happy to respond. Don't ask for images for free. Make a donation. The ASMP wanted an image of Eddie Adams, and they just loved one of my portraits of Eddie Adams. This is the American Society of Media Photographers Northern California chapter, and also being a 501c3 and being the people that set the standards for the photograph, for photographic practices and the business things. They donated $20 for the portrait. I mean, I understand they're a nonprofit. They're struggling like me, so it goes with the package. But socially, we need to start appreciating the impact of the image.
So true. And I really appreciate your time today, Paul. We want to chat again about some of the other things that have been going on with LAMP. And just to get your retrospect on what's going on and listen to your passion about this organization and what you've been doing is very cool, and I really appreciate it.
Well, Scott, it's truly been a privilege and an honor speaking with you. I'm moved deeply and personally by your passion and interest in the photographic community, and I'm touched by your interest in my work and especially your interest in the project. Thank you for having me as a guest.
Well, there you go. Paul Waldman, what a great organization he is running to capture and to document these American masters. This is great stuff. You definitely got to check out Paul's website. There's a lot of help that he can use to get this thing rolling, keep it alive. This is great work that Paul's doing. I think other photographers should help out to keep this program alive. This is great work that Paul's doing. Definitely check out his website. The Inside Analog Photography radio program has been brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful over at www.fujifilmusa.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab at richardphotolab.com. DR5 over at www.dr5.com. Iger Studios over at igerstudios.com. Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. And of course, our media partners, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, over at www.apug.org. Our photography philanthropy partners, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, over at www.geh.org. I've been your host, Scott Chipper, here on Inside Analog Photography Radio. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.